Hello, I am Eli Adachi, Professor of Medical Science at Brown University and host of Medscape One-on-One. Joining me today is Dr. Joseph Selby, a family physician, a health service researcher, and the first executive director of the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, or PCORI for short. Welcome.
Thank you, Dr. Adachi.
Is there a better way to abbreviate the name of your institute?
I don't know if there's a better way to abbreviate it, but
how
we like
roll
to
off
say
your tongue?
PCORI.
PCORI.
There you go.
Well, we'll try and adapt that in the context of the conversation. Delighted to have you.
Thanks.
Thank you for joining us. Let's perhaps begin with some basics. What was it that led to the establishment of PCORI? And while we're at it, what is it primarily about?
Good questions. I think the creation of PCORI as part of the Affordable Care Act was the culmination of a process that goes back 10, maybe even 20 years. Several processes that came together. A growing appreciation that patients and their clinicians, despite the hundreds of millions of dollars poured into clinical research each year in this country, often find themselves at the point of needing to make a decision and not quite having the information they need. Mm-hmm. Either the research covered patients that weren't quite like the patient in the office at that moment, or the research did not address a particular outcome that is important to this patient. The research may not have gone on long enough to identify the perhaps rare safety outcome that now the patient is wondering about. So a growing appreciation that research has not really come to meet all the needs of patients and their clinicians, number one. Mm-hmm. Number two, a growing appreciation that it's important to do research in real-world settings where patients get their care, and that with the advent of, for example, the electronic health record and other computerized databases, we may be getting to the point where observational studies can help complement clinical trials research. The idea of comparative effectiveness research, where practical comparisons between two or more treatment options that patients are considering get considered, where the full range of outcomes that are important to patients get measured and compared, where the study is done in real patients with their multiple comorbidities and their extremes of age and functional status, and where attention is paid to the possibility that the treatments might have different effects in different individuals, and we may be able to spot characteristics that will predict who's going to benefit from a treatment and who's not. All of that, which came to be called in the first decade of this century comparative effectiveness research, was on the minds of legislators who were crafting the Affordable Care Act. Comparative effectiveness research, or comparative clinical effectiveness research, was the purpose for which PCORI was authorized. At about the same time, comparative effectiveness research went through a phase where it was linked in some people's minds to rationing, to cost-effectiveness measurement, and had transiently acquired a dubious name. So they did not call it the Comparative Effectiveness Research Institute. They labeled it instead the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute, and that's made a big difference. But we were authorized to be established in order to conduct the kind of research that engages patients and clinicians and addresses questions that are important to them.
I'm going to assume that the precise provenance of the idea is probably difficult to ascertain. In other words, no single individual, no single interest group, no single political party. However, can you shed some light on, best you can tell, how this made it into the bill? And it may not be possible.
Well, again, I just think that we see a growing interest. First, we talked about outcomes research back in the late 80s and early 90s. The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, formerly known as the AHCPR, funded the patient outcomes research teams in the early 90s. That was an appreciation that we needed to collect outcomes data. The notion of comparative effectiveness research itself, I think, arose more early in the 21st century. The Medicare Modernization Act authorized the funding of centers through the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality that would begin doing some comparative research. That was in, I believe, 2003. So that by the time that the Affordable Care Act was being considered, there was a lot of interest, a lot of appreciation for the fact that research was not meeting needs. And there was some thought that comparative effectiveness research, among other things, could identify wasteful therapies, could identify decisions that were currently being made in the absence of evidence. Yes. So, you know, the default might be, if I don't know if it works or not, I might as well try it. Comparative effectiveness research was seen as a vehicle for getting more answers out there, more information at the disposal of decision makers.
By all accounts, you know, multiple earlier investments were made in the same notion, and it seems very reasonable to assume that when the bill was crafted, the idea really has reached a level of maturity which ended up with a more decisive blow this time and the establishment of the institute you're currently the executive director of. Could you say a word or two about how PCORI is financed? Where does it derive its budget from?
Sure. The budget is very clearly specified for each year from 2010 through 2019 in the legislation. So the funding ramped up gradually. It was $10 million in 2010, $50 million in 2011, $150 million this year, 2012. And each of those contributions comes directly from the Treasury. Yes. From here on out, each year, the Treasury will contribute $150 million. But beginning in 2013, actually beginning in fiscal year 2013, so in October, an additional source of income is a fee levied on every insured person, be that through CMS, Medicare, be it through private insurance or employer-sponsored self-insurance. So that's estimated to generate an amount of money which, when added to the $150 million, means that in 2013, the total money flowing into the PCORI Trust Fund will be $350 million. Beginning in 2014 through 2019, something over $500 million mm-hmm. will go into the PCORI Trust Fund.
So taxpayers' support, in a sense, comes in two forms. On the one hand, through the Treasury. On the other hand, through individual contributions, in a sense, that make up the remainder of the budget.
If health plans choose to put that $1, the fee is $1 in 2013 and $2 per enrolled person in 2014, and if that translates to an increase in premiums, then you could say citizens were covering that part of it.
What is the reporting structure, if any, or is PCORI independent such that it is not accountable to the obvious or usual suspects?
Right. Well, we are independent in the sense that we are not an agency or department of government. I report to a 21-person Board of Governors. Mm-hmm. The Board of Governors was appointed by the Government Accountability Office, the GAO.
Okay.
But that is my line of reporting to the Board of Governors.
And I imagine they were selected because of their reputation and because of their known independence as well.
Absolutely, and the GAO did a remarkable job of selecting 21 remarkable individuals. It was specified in the legislation that the board be a multi-stakeholder group, So on the board, you see patients and their caregivers represented. You see clinicians, physicians, nurses, chiropractors. You see hospitals. You see health plans. You see employers. You see government. And you see industry, all represented on this multi-stakeholder board.
Thank you. A question you almost certainly have heard before, and some of our viewers almost certainly contemplated, has to do with the distinction between PCORI and other undertakings out there, such as the Cochrane Collaboration or programs that engage on a routine basis in systematic reviews or meta-analysis of data. In what way does PCORI stand out relative to those other efforts? And where is it unique and distinct, which I'm sure it is, but where is it, where is the difference that makes it plain to see that it's a very different animal?
Well, I think the most striking difference is that we are a research funding institution. The Cochrane Collaboration collects and disseminates and guides the creation of evidence syntheses. We fund, we will fund some evidence syntheses, but we'll also fund a lot of empirical research, both observational research and randomized comparisons. So we are a funding agency of substantial size in distinction to, as you mentioned, the Cochrane Collaboration and actually several European organizations that synthesize data and actually go beyond synthesis to supporting policymaking. The other distinguishing characteristic is it's quite clear that we don't make policy. We generate information.
Would it be reasonable to state that your budget as it evolves would be largely spent on grants, the remainder being spent on administrative overhead?
That's by and large, that's right. I'll throw in one little fact that we haven't mentioned to this point, which is that of the money that I described going into the trust fund, 20% of it goes to either the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality or other parts of Health and Human Services. So 20% of that total goes back. And ARC's portion in particular is earmarked for dissemination.
ARC standing for?
The Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality.
Thank you.
A part of Health and Human
AHRQ,
Services.
AHRQ, yes.
Yes, AHRQ. So it goes to dissemination, and it also goes to training, so developing manpower to do this kind of research. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, you're absolutely right. Of the 80% that comes to PCORI, the vast majority, probably 80% of that, will go toward funding research. You said grants. The legislation says contracts. We see a variety of kinds of funding arrangements from very frank contracts to a large amount of research that is initiated by scientists in the research community, partnered with patients and other stakeholders. Mm-hmm. So although we call them contracts, they may have some of the feeling of grants.
Can we assume that the applications will be peer-reviewed as they are at the NIH or in other circumstances, and that reports would be issued by the investigator as they progress and so forth?
Yes, precisely. Right now we are working with NIH, and the NIH, we had a small round of pilot projects that were solicited last fall and reviewed in February. They were reviewed by the Center for Scientific Review at NIH. We will be letting large funding announcements at the end of May. And those funding announcements, the applications will again be reviewed by the Center for Scientific Review. We work closely with them. We modify the review criteria. We participate in recruiting the reviewers who sit on these panels, and we add three patient or stakeholder reviewers to every panel. That's quite different from the typical NIH review. So we have three patients that we will work with in advance to make sure that the research we're funding can be said to be truly patient-centered and to have patients engaged in the process.
That's wonderful. As the executive director of PCORI, how would you define your roles, or how do you divide your time? Maybe another way of asking the same question.
Well, you know, we are still in startup mode, so the phrase that we use in the office is all hands on deck. So I will be recruiting one moment and helping to write a funding announcement the next and giving a presentation somewhere the next and working with the board, either, you know, on teleconferences or preparing for meetings or one-on-ones. So, and the same can be said for all of my colleagues, the 18 people who are now employees at PCORI.
As we follow the progression of the Institute, earlier this year in January, and I think more recently in March, some significant pronouncements were made that seemed to be very fundamental to the mission and the direction of the Institute. Could you say something about the types of deliberations that transpired thus far and the statements or documents that were generated thereupon?
You bet. The first one, temporarily, the first one that came out was the definition of patient-centered outcomes research.
Yes.
So we were charged with conducting comparative clinical effectiveness research. We were called the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute. It begged the question of what is patient-centered outcomes research and how does it relate to comparative clinical effectiveness research. So we had a very lengthy process wherein our methodology committee, a distinct committee from the board, also appointed by the GAO, 17 experts from across the country in every aspect of comparative effectiveness and patient-centered outcomes research, deliberated at length on what patient-centered outcomes research is and concluded and posted a draft definition last August that essentially said that patient-centered outcomes research is research done in collaboration with patients that allows the patient's voice to be heard as specific questions are asked and addressed. And the four questions are, given my personal characteristics and my clinical characteristics, what can I expect will happen to me? That's prognosis. Similarly, given my personal characteristics, my clinical characteristics, what treatment options are available to me and what are their relative benefits and harms of each? Similarly, what, given who I am, what behaviors, what can I do to see that I achieve the outcomes that I prefer? So that addresses self-care and behaviors. And the fourth is, again, given who I am, what can the healthcare system do to support me in gaining the information and making the decisions that I need to make to obtain the outcomes I prefer? So that's the definition. It was posted for public comment. 600 and some public comments came in via the website, mail. That was analyzed in depth. Focus groups were held with patients and with clinicians. And the methodology committee took all that input, and we posted a revised definition of patient-centered outcomes research. That definition will be in every funding announcement we ever release, and applicants will need to tell us how their research fits with that definition. The second critical piece of work that we've done in the last few months is to lay out PCORI's national priorities for research and our research agenda. And just in a nutshell, the five priorities for PCORI research include assessments of prevention, diagnosis, and treatment options faced by patients, improving healthcare systems, communications and dissemination research, that is, how do we get the information out and how in better ways, and how do we communicate patients and clinicians about the evidence. The fourth is addressing disparities, and the fifth is building infrastructure for conducting patient-centered outcomes research. And that set of priorities and the agenda which goes with it, which is a broad agenda, which really says we are open to compelling questions regardless of the condition that fit within these five priorities. That was posted in January, late January. Public comment on that closed March 15th, and we will have a meeting, a webcast meeting on April the 25th, wherein the board will review the proposals, the proposed refinements in the research agenda and the national priorities. Once those are in place, we can release those funding announcements I mentioned, which will come out in late May.
Is it fair to say that these very fundamental statements, in a sense, clarified and cemented the mission of the Institute and provided you with a well-backed-up and well-reasoned way of communicating your raison d'etre?
Yes, I think they give us a very solid foundation. It's easy, and the more you practice it, the easier it gets to use those five priorities as a way of talking about what we need to know and what needs to improve so that what we know can actually be put into practice. They also, though, because of how broad they are, they also point to the essential next task of PCORI. So aside from getting these funding announcements out, our biggest task is to set up ways to communicate with patients, with patient advocacy associations, with clinicians of all stripes, clinicians on the front lines, clinicians organized in associations, with payers, with health plans and employer groups, with all of those who need this kind of information. We need to set up ongoing two-way dialogue. It may be through web-based dialogue and input. It may be through convening work groups or advisory committees or advisory councils. But PCORI needs a way to work with its stakeholders to make sure that our agenda is meeting patient needs. You may see us over time. We almost suspect that you'll see us over time honing in on a smaller number of more focused areas and putting special emphasis and more resources in those areas. But that will be done not hastily. It'll be done hopefully with consensus among the wide range of stakeholders and with an eye on what will best serve the country and its patients.
The following statement may be self-evident, but I want to take us somewhere. PCORI seems to me stands out especially because of its focus on the patient. Generating new information for providers, important as it is probably not a new concept, shall we say. I think the intense focus on the patient, as you articulated, seems to me to set you apart in ways that could not be extrapolated to other organizations. Although we all are seeking and striving to engage the patient in the decision-making process, to maintain the patients informed, etc., this is still an evolving arena, I think you would agree. And it stands to change in ways perhaps unforeseen the dynamics of the relationship between patient and provider. I'm all but certain that we've given this a lot of thought. In which context, could you say just a few words about how you see that relationship evolving in a way that will be influenced by PCORI, but not just?
I'll give you my pipe dream. We very clearly see as our two primary sets of clients, patients and the clinicians who join them in making decisions, because most decisions are made jointly. At least ideally, most decisions are made jointly. Perhaps sometimes you could argue today still more decisions than ought to be are made primarily by clinicians. So we may move toward a time when patients are more engaged. The last thing we want to do is to somehow isolate patients from their clinicians. I mean, we think that's a precious relationship. We want to strengthen it. We think that both patients and clinicians, number one, need better information, and number two, frankly, need to be able to understand information better than they do today. So our job is not only to generate more information, and by the way, I think key questions do come from clinicians. I don't think patients will generate all the relevant questions. So my vision, our vision, is that patients, clinicians, by the way, when I say patients, I mean patients and in many cases their caregivers. Mm-hmm. So for the child, maybe a parent. Mm-hmm. For the aging adult, it may be a child. Mm-hmm. For a variety of patients, it may be someone other than themselves. Mm-hmm. But we'll use the word patients. We see critical questions coming from each of those groups. I go to a meeting, I talk to a family doc in at noon. The family doc has been in the clinic in the morning. They've run into three great questions just that morning. One of them might be answerable just by referring them to the literature as it stands. The second might be answerable if we synthesized a wide range of evidence that's out there. But at least one in three is going to be a bona fide question that needs empirical work. We need to study different outcomes, or we need to study different comparisons. Or we need to study the same question in a different, more broader patient population. So I genuinely think that patients and providers and clinicians will generate the questions. And I think we need to keep both at the table and stay engaged with both. And I think the relationship will ideally, that's my pipe dream, change by both patients and clinicians becoming better consumers of evidence because they've asked for the evidence that they need.
Yes. Thinking ahead, because PCORI is undergirded by the Affordable Care Act, I assume it is subject to the same threats as is the Affordable Care Act itself. First, with respect to the outcome of the deliberations of the Supreme Court, later on potentially by the outcome of the elections. Have there been provisions made in the Affordable Care Act or elsewhere to deal with those contingencies, unforeseen as they likely have been, certainly the former? And what would it really mean to PCORI if one or both come about in a negative fashion?
I think at this point it's just not it's not a good use of our time to speculate. Even, you know, the first question obviously is what will the Supreme Court's decision be? Right. But even beyond that, a lot will have to be settled in lower courts and elsewhere and in Congress. So we can't really afford to take our eye off building the organization. Right. So by and large, we don't. We move ahead.
Understood. If I may conclude on a personal note, I was wondering if you would care to share with our viewers some of the seminar influences and events that ended up attracting you to health services research, to health policy, and to the activities you're currently pursuing, considering the fact that you began your career almost certainly as a practicing family physician, and at one point you obviously evolved in a somewhat different direction. Can you trace some of that evolution for us?
Well, I mean, at my age, that could be a long discussion. But you're right. I had, when I went to medical school and trained as a family physician, it never crossed my mind that I would write a scientific article or publish something in the New England Journal or write a grant. I saw myself seeing patients in a neighborhood health center forever. 7 years into my experience at a neighborhood health center in Oakland, California, we got a computer. Our first computer was about 4 feet tall and 2 feet wide. And not long after that, we realized that we could find all of our patients with diabetes. in the computer, at least all those who for whom we had checked on the encounter form a diagnosis of diabetes. And because we did, we in those days we billed, we really could find our diabetic patients. We pulled them all and we sent them a postcard in October saying, time for your flu shot, come in. And a couple months later, the dean of the School of Public Health at University of California, Berkeley, came by and she began talking to us about community-oriented primary care and precisely doing that, using computers to get to know your population and identifying the problems that the population faced and coming up with solutions that that began by understanding what problems your patients were experiencing. You begin to see patterns. You begin to see places where you're falling down. You begin to see opportunities. She said, you've got to learn to do epidemiology in order to do that. And so I took a little time off from the clinic. I went to study epidemiology at the School of Public Health there and fell in love with it. From there, I made my way as a an intern, so to speak, or a fellow to Kaiser Permanente. And Kaiser Permanente was a place where, in those days, there was not a lot of computerized data yet, but there was a defined population. And gradually over time, first doing etiologic epidemiology, and then as the clinical data improved, moving more toward health services research, I began to get very interested in outcome studies and the use of large databases and trials, particularly things like the idea of a large practical trial in a population or a cluster randomized trial. The 21st century dawned, and one set of conversations I'll never forget were with Sean Tunis, who at that time was at, I believe he was at, he was either at CMS, I think he may be at CMS, but he was writing a paper about practical clinical trials.
He was the chief medical officer
yes,
of CMS.
That, and I'm not quite sure that that was during the time when he was, but he was writing this very interesting paper with Carolyn Clancy from ARC and Dan Stryer on practical clinical trials, and that got me much more energized. And then CER sort of took off, and I began writing grants to do CER. And so when somebody, when I was called to say, might you be interested in thinking about the position at PCORI, I was primed.
Well, thank you for sharing, and thank you for joining us today.
Yes.
On this note, sincere thanks to Dr. Joseph Selby and to you, our viewers, for joining Medscape One-on-One. Until next time, I am Eli Adashi.